So you stole that, too, Stoke Jones said from his bed in the infirmary when he could finally talk. I had just told him that almost everyone in Chamberlain Hall was now wearing the Sparrow Track on at least one article of clothing, thinking this news would cheer him up. I had been wrong. Settle down, man, Skip said, patting his shoulder. Don't have a hemorrhage. Stoke never so much as glanced at him. His black, accusing eyes remained on me. You took the credit, then you took the peace sign. Did any of you check my wallet? I think there were $9 or $10 in there. You could have had that, too, made it a clean sweep. He turned his head aside and began to cough weakly. On that cold day in early December of 66, he looked one fuck of a lot older than 18. This was 4 days after Stoke went swimming in Bennett's Run. The doctor, Carberry his name was, seemed by the second of those days to accept that most of us were Stoke's friends no matter how oddly we'd acted when we brought him in, because we kept stopping by to ask after him. Carberry had been at the college infirmary, prescribing for strep throats and splitting wrists dislocated in softball games, for donkey's years, and probably knew there was no accounting for the behavior of young men and women homing in on their majority. They might look like adults, but most retained plenty of their childhood weirdnesses as well. Nick Prouty auditioning Foghorn Leghorn for the Dean of Men, for instance. I rest my case. Carberry never told us how bad things had been with Stoke. One of the candy stripers, half in love with Skip by the second time she saw him, I believe, gave us a clearer picture, not that we really needed one. The fact that Carberry stuck him in a private room instead of on men's side told us something. The fact that we weren't allowed to so much as peek in on him for the first 48 hours of his stay told us more. The fact that he hadn't been moved to Eastern Maine, which was only 10 miles up the road, told us most of all. Carberry hadn't dared move him, not even in the university ambulance. Stoke Jones had been in bad straits indeed. According to the candy striper, he had pneumonia, incipient hypothermia from his dunk, and a temperature which crested at 105 degrees. She'd overheard Carberry talking with someone on the phone and saying that if Jones's lung capacity had been any further reduced by his disability, or if he'd been in his 30s or 40s instead of his late teens, he almost certainly would have died. Skip and I were the first visitors he was allowed. Any other kid in the dorm probably would have been visited by at least one parent, but that wasn't going to happen in Stokes' case. We knew that now. And if there were other relatives, they hadn't bothered to put in an appearance. We told him everything that had happened that night, with one exception, the laugh-in, which had begun in the lounge when we saw him spraying his way through Bennett's Run, and continued until we delivered him, semi-conscious, to the infirmary. He listened silently as I told him about Skip's idea to put peace signs on our books and clothes so Stoke couldn't be hung out all by himself. Even Ronnie Malenfant had gone along, I said, and without a single quibble. We told him so he could jibe his story with ours. We also told him so he'd understand that by trying to take the blame or credit for the graffiti now, he'd get us in trouble as well as himself. And we told him without ever coming right out and telling him. We didn't need to. His legs didn't work, but the stuff between his ears was just fine.